Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists share their most recent work. This week, I had the honor of talking with Paul van Lange, professor of psychology at the Free University of Amsterdam and distinguished research fellow at Oxford. He is well known for his vast work on trust, cooperation, and morality, applying these themes to everything from COVID to climate change. He has published multiple handbooks and edited volumes on these topics. In this chat, I asked Paul to talk about the psychological barriers that stop people from fighting climate change. What do trust and cynicism have to do with it? What are barriers to cooperation more generally? Why do selfish people often believe others are selfish too, but kind people don't think everyone is kind? Might most strangers actually be nice, despite all the stranger danger we always hear about? Finally, Paul shares if all his work on trust and cooperation has changed how he looks at the world, and compares research in psychology in Europe to the US. Hope you enjoy.
Very excited today on the Stanford Psychology Podcast to be talking with Paul van Lange about trust and cooperation and climate change. Really important topics. But first of all, thank you for making the time.
Thank you. This is a real honor and a real pleasure as well.
Okay. On your website, you say that nothing is as basic to social life as trust and human cooperation. Now, the problem for every researcher, of course, to the person with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? Everyone thinks they are working on the most important stuff in life. But in your case, I am tempted to agree. Trust and cooperation really are this basic. But I wonder if you could make the case for our listeners. Why are these topics so important if we want to understand social life?
Interesting. A very nice question to begin with. I would say that even, and this is a very intuitive answer, rather than a very scientific one. But if you think of what are the things in life that you would lose sleep on, it's probably not that your geranium in your backyard is also, that may matter as well. It's almost more social than you think, but it's probably more about other human beings. So it's about something that you did wrong to another person. You said the wrong thing. Another person may think badly about you, maybe for the wrong reasons, maybe to some degree for actually valid reasons. Those are issues that are of high concern to people, and they are very important. So social life is anything to people that keeps them going, basically. And also, and because it is positive and negative, you may also lose sleep over it. And when you think of all of that, I think that other people are in part also, in some way, you could say the reason for life. If you were just by yourself, I think that many people would not survive, actually, because life would be too boring. You cannot, many of the concepts that we use, from empathy to aggression to irritation to frustration to some degree, are inherently social. And when I use the term inherently social, I immediately think about two things, actually, that the rewards, basically, that we get from others, which is very important, and rewards is a very big term, and it's especially the immaterial rewards, very basic, the need to belong, for example, that you share your laughter is very important, that you share some overlap in your outlook on life, for example, or your perceptions is very important to people. And secondary, it's, of course, that other people are very essential to working together. People alone could not survive. You can only survive with, in the presence of others, and when working together to some degree with other people.
And yet, despite the importance of our social life and our social connections, there are many people out there who will say, I don't need anyone. People can't be trusted. People are selfish. There's nothing you can do about it. And this is where the topic of climate change, interestingly enough, comes in, and how we can fight climate change. And you have reviewed evidence about what stops us from caring about climate change more. And there's different borders you bring up, borders of thought, borders of time, borders of space. But when it comes to borders of thought, you talk about this cynical, defeatist narrative. And I wonder if you could link that for our listeners to climate change.
Yeah, it's borders of thought. It's a very general term. And indeed, there are the three borders, and I would like to discuss them, all three of them, because I think they are very important. But the borders of thought, actually, the first one is already that you mentioned, because there's the myth of self-interest. People have a clear tendency to overestimate selfishness in other people, not in themselves, but in other people. And this may well be to some degree that it's only sometimes a fraction of other people that displays behavior that you really disapprove of. And that may disproportionately influence your perception and your beliefs as well. There are more mechanisms to it, but the myth of self-interest is already a border of thought that if you, in any type of uncertain situation, you think, well, everybody's going to be self-interested, everybody's going to choose for him or herself, that is already a sort of boundary condition. You can be trapped in that kind of belief. And so you have to loosen up a little bit and have a more open mind, because I think that, and there's also evolutionary speaking, it would not make sense if people are really only interested in themselves or only interested in the short term as well, to be honest. Because you need, every now and then, you need to have a broader mind regarding others and regarding the time as well. I will discuss that later on as well. What I find interesting when I think of the borders of thought, for example, is also people can have no clear idea of how to do things. For example, there may be another very important misunderstanding at the moment, which is that people may think that climate change is so difficult that you can hardly do anything about it. And also, even if you can make a small contribution, people may not really realize how they can do it, or that they think it would be too costly. For example, I find the idea of flying an interesting one. I know that in countries other than the Netherlands, flying is sometimes a must in order to get around. And in the Netherlands, you could take the train, and in Europe, you could often take the train. But that's only one of the behaviors that is relevant to climate change. Other forms of behavior that are not known that are also very nice is, for example, to buy off-season products. If you buy, which I tended to do until recently, if you buy strawberries in the winter in the Netherlands, for example, you know that those strawberries are either produced under high energy, climate unfriendly circumstances in the Netherlands itself, or they are produced somewhere, let's say, close to the equator or in a warmer climate, and then they have to be often flown to the Netherlands rather than shipped. And that's also because of the time issue. And so that's frozen, that also takes energy. So that's not a climate friendly option. It's a climate friendly option to consume off season products, for example. I recently made a shift. I went from strawberries to pears, and they are equally delicious. It was not, I would say strawberries are a little bit nicer, but then again, I wouldn't call this a sacrifice. It's just a thoughtfulness issue, low-cost cooperation, as I would call it. And the other, another example is buy plants that have flowers rather than flowers per se, because flowers is also something that is very taxing on climate change. And if you can prevent that, because for the same reasons, actually, as off-season fruits, because they have to be flown in or they are produced in your own country at a large cost, for example. Of course, this depends a little bit on where you live, but these are very small, doable behaviors. Shorter shower is also, I think, quite doable. If you take your mobile phone and you think of a nice short song, there you go. That can all help.
And it's interesting because there are so many things we can do to reduce the risk of climate change. And yet, as you say, the myth of self-interest comes in the way where we don't even hear about all the pro-social things people are doing for the sake of fighting climate change. Because all we hear, maybe especially in the news, is this corporation, that corporation, everyone is just, no one cares. Everyone just does whatever they want. And so if you think that's the norm, then it's easy to follow along with that norm and not even know what you could be doing when, in fact, so many people are doing things, and we just need to be informed about them and hear about them. Okay, so that's borders of thought.
Yes, and the nice thing is also that if you show it, actually, then you're adding to something very important. You're adding to a descriptive norm that now everybody thinks that if you want to be nice to your wife, or you, in the Netherlands, if you go on a visit, dinner party, let's say, you bring flowers, sometimes wine, which is more common in the States, I think, but then all of a sudden, if you get all of a sudden a plant with flowers, a blooming plant, that's different. And then you're really adding to the descriptive norm. And that really helps if people, because I think there are actually two major predictors to people's behavior. One is that what that other people are doing, basically the descriptive norm, especially people that are close in your environment. So that will really extend the borders of thought, so to speak. And the other predictor of your own behavior is, of course, your own past behavior. your habits. So if you, that model is very simple, but I often use it with the media. If media asks me questions, why do people do this and this or that? It's often if you use those two ingredients, you actually, many journalists will be very happy if you provide that analysis to whatever problem. For example, a problem like people do not respond to any kind of alarms is one thing that, that sometimes is a question that I might get, for example.
All right. So you have successfully broadened our thinking. But that's not enough. Turns out we also have to broaden our thinking across time. And this is where we borders of time and how we have to think about our children, for example, even if we might not even have children yet.
Yep. Yeah, interesting. Yes. Many people would say that also from an evolutionary perspective, people are short-term oriented. But I think that when we evolve as a species, you gradually, and that differs perhaps a little bit according to climatological conditions. But for example, let's assume a climate where there are seasons. Then, and with the beginning of agriculture, and then you need to take a longer time perspective in terms of you need to plan a little bit to seed and to harvest months later or more than half a year later. So that's really a planning issue. And sometimes people really need to plan in life. And even early on, I would say, it's not only planning on a daily, on a short-term level, but sometimes also somewhat longer-term level. So I do think that people can have actually evolved to also think a little bit more about the longer term. I also believe that raising children to some degree also brings about this time frame. And when talking about children, this is an interesting idea because the closest thing to selfishness is actually kinship-based prosociality. You do it not for yourself, but you do it for your offspring, your children. And in that particular case, this could be a very powerful mechanism to persuade people who are a little bit older who have children, and sometimes also people who have grandchildren, to persuade them to do more about climate change, to help mitigate climate change. And actually, when you look at the people who are protesting on the street, it is actually true that it is actually the younger generation, let's say between 15 and 30 or so, and it is the people sometimes who are like 65 and older. And they do it not for themselves so much, but they do it for the children and grandchildren, I believe. And that's also interesting. It's a very powerful reason for people to take climate change very seriously and to do something about it. And then there's also something else that I found really interesting. I did research with colleagues in Germany about how advisors differ from people. And something that we heard was that if advisors take your position, they are much more likely to think in terms of the longer term than you do as the evolved decision maker. For example, when you buy a house, you probably think about the size of the kitchen, maybe the size of the bathroom, maybe with some extensions that you expect, you think of all sorts of the number of rooms, et cetera, et cetera. But you think, generally speaking, you think in the here and now a little bit and how they matter. But suppose that you have an advisor may, for example, for a whole community, that advisor may, for example, takes a more distal perspective. And with that distance, sometimes the advisor is more likely to think about the longer term effects, consequences of planning. And then the advisor may, for example, think about all sorts of things that are relevant to climate change in terms of how you build a house, how climate friendly, how you can make benefits, draw the benefits from sun, for example, et cetera, et cetera. So that's also another tool that you sometimes can use, that advisors are more likely to think about the not so much about the here and now, because we are involved as actors, but as advisors, we take the longer time perspective. So if governments are smart in that sense, they would include a lot of advisors in many decisions that are relevant to climate change.
Right. Let's think about our kids. Let's think more in a long-term perspective. Realize people are already doing so many things and don't be too defeatist all about it. Do you think there's a difference between these interventions in who they target? Who is the target for these interventions? And that I could see that some people who are already very skeptical that climate change is happening or that maybe it's happening, but we shouldn't care. These interventions might backfire. They might, you're telling me I don't care about my kids. So who do you think is the target for these interventions? And do you think they might have to be worded or tailored differently depending on who we are talking to?
That's also very interesting. And then you almost, you get basically at the third border, which is the border of space. And to me, very important because you have to target the message a little bit through the local circumstances. In the Netherlands, it's not so impressive to talk about heat as a risk factor. But if you, of course, live closer to the equator, heat is a serious issue. And I even have the feeling that many people might underestimate the stress that heat causes in people. Even if you have air conditioning and everything, then still, but many people do not have that, actually. That's also maybe a bias that we have. But suppose that you have that, then still heat is a really a stressor in life. And so people might not be able to fully understand or be able to take the perspective of refugees that at a certain moment are climate-related refugees, as they call them, people who just want to seek refuge because of horrible climate circumstances. And that may at a certain moment happen in some situations. Apart from the increased risk of hazards, the increases in temperature is also something, a very burdensome, almost unlivable environment. But I think in communication activities, it's important to always think of the local circumstances. And I think more generally, I think when you have a successful campaign, it's very important to think about the situations that people themselves face in the here and now and in the future, but in the local circumstances, because otherwise, in Dutch, we say you missed the boat, but it means then you are actually not, your communication is far from optimal. But I think when it comes to the border of space, something that I also find really interesting is that we typically think, and this is my domain of expertise, actually, it's the social dilemmas, a conflict between short-term self-interest and longer-term collective interest. But actually, when you think of climate change, that is part of the problem, that social dilemma, but it's also an intergroup dilemma because it's, for example, the different countries have to come to an agreement, the different within a country, sometimes even the different regions have to come to an agreement. And so that's very important. You have to work together as groups. And then other mechanisms also play a very important role that you can probably strategically use very optimally.
Yeah, and you make the very compelling case that groups can be more competitive than individuals. And we often talk about groups as if they represented just a bunch of individuals, and that's all it is, right? China retaliated against the US. What does that really mean? It really means that Chinese leaders retaliated against US leaders who did something else. And oftentimes we mistake our leaders for the whole group. But it turns out, if you lead a country, you're probably a bit of a weird person in that you can be more extreme and competitive and dominating and have certain personality traits that might exacerbate conflict. And yet we act as if these individuals perfectly represent us.
Yes, I completely agree. And people are, it's psychologically also very interesting that people, as when they are taking the role of representative, something happens in their minds. And they become different from when they are individuals. And that's actually fascinating. I sometimes think that people are naturally quite good, but groups are bad. And I think that sort of tells it all. But what is important about representatives is that they are very sensitive to, again, reputation. And I will later say more about reputation, about what other people think of them. And especially in their role of a representer or a leader, basically. And very, very sensitive to what the constituency thinks of them. And so they sometimes are more selfish than they wish to be, just to make sure that they do well for their own group. And that's a powerful mechanism, actually. And actually, the group members also support one another in being selfish for the group, basically. So typically, this is a very problematic situation, especially when it comes to, for example, climate change, when you have negotiations between countries to some degree, the leaders also have to get the support from all the people who live in their own country. It's not easy for them. But there's one solution, at least something that I think is very important. If you can somehow trigger or promote the reputational concerns with that, which I think are so very strong, that are broader than only your own in-group, then you can really gain. And I find solutions, and this is a little bit more small scale, but I think it's creative in the sense that things like, for example, who has the cleanest city in the Netherlands? Or what is the cleanest state in the United States? Or which state is most climate friendly? At a certain moment, if you formulate those goals, then you get, of course, all the people who represent states, and in the Netherlands, the mayors who represent their cities, for example, then they become very sensitive to that kind of symbolic gain. And they are much more likely to compete with other mayors as well for good causes and for good actions. And so this is a very nice way to to use competition and to as a means to promote cooperation, basically, but in this particular case, to promote environmental friendly behavior or climate friendly behavior, as you want to call it. And that to me is a fascinating logic that is actually somewhat underused, I believe. We can do more about it with the rankings a little bit, making salient where people stand, where nations stand, and then rub it in. People will find it uneasy and uncomfortable if they see that, for example, their own country is just below efforts. And I know that's we have a lot of rankings that we should, and often they are displayed in the media. And I think people are quite sensitive to this. And that's nice.
I do wonder, and this is where we're zooming out to the topics of trust and cooperation more generally as they apply to climate change, but also to other topics. What extent is there a certain level of agreement that we have to share before we can together fight an issue? Oftentimes people talk about having a common enemy will bring people together. COVID-19 in the United States, highly polarized, will bring the country together. And no, yes. I think it's fair to say that did not exactly happen. And in many other countries, you can find something similar. And so it seems like you need a certain base level of agreement on what the problem is and how to fight it, a certain level of trust between people before a common enemy can unite you.
I believe that, generally speaking, I would say that a common enemy, generally speaking, does, all things, you know, being equal, does increase trust and cooperation. I believe even at COVID-19, at the beginning, when the urgency was the highest and when the threat was the highest, at the very beginning, and I'm talking about the first, let's say, 6 weeks, what you saw in that period, and I think that was quite general, was an increase in helpfulness to some degree, or at least kindness. That all of a sudden people were, for example, in the Netherlands, we have a very nice facility, which is that volunteers can, and I'm sure you have this in the States as well, can volunteer to be a sort of a non-professional counselor for people who face problems of loneliness, for example, or other, could be any problem in principle. And it's a small training that people get in advance, and they call it the listening telephone. And the listening telephone service is something that was very successful right after COVID started. And they had actually too many volunteers. Many people wanted to volunteer. And this is something that I tend to see, that there was increasing kindness, low-cost cooperation, and also sometimes higher-cost cooperation, which I call helpfulness. And this was also seen at the beginning. But then later on, what you saw, in my view, was an increase in intergroup conflict, a polarization between between groups, between the people who wanted to be vaccinated and those who did not want to be vaccinated. Also, between countries, you saw an increase in stereotyping. In Holland, there was a little bit of a stereotyping, and I'm actually a little bit ashamed of it regarding China, for example, that there are quite a few people, Chinese people in Amsterdam. And yeah, so there was an increase in discrimination, actually, you could call it. So that was all intergroup. And at the level of interpersonal level, people were a little bit more cooperative, certainly in the beginning. And maybe later on, there were other things, and it was hard for me to judge that. But in the beginning, there was an increase in, as an illustration, that the nice listening telephone service was actually quite successful in the beginning.
So I guess these different topics we have talked about can be framed as different situations that make us as a species, people, more or less cooperative, depending on the context and the group we're in and what dynamics are at play. But of course, it's not all the situation. Personality is a thing. And there are some stable differences where it seems that some people just tend to be more selfish than others. And it's easy to place people on a certain spectrum from selfish to kind or cooperative. But you've actually made a very useful distinction, I think, between people you call individualists, competitors, and pro-socials. Adding some nuance to this debate, I wonder if you could introduce our listeners to these different groups of people.
Yeah, this was my first line of research, and called social value orientation. And it's still, I'm addicted to this kind of research, so to speak. I still find it intriguing. And so, yes, there are three types. And the first type is pro-social. And that's a combination of two motives, actually, that people are concerned about collective outcomes, so to speak, what happens to our group, or what happens to the diet as a total, as a group, or as a unit. And they are also concerned about equality. They really prefer equality in outcomes. That's what, and they are correlated. And that's what constitutes pro-social orientation. And about 50 to 60% of the people can be classified as pro-social. Then there are individualists, and I would call it a euphemism for being selfish, people who prioritize their own outcomes. And we have a lot of measures that actually that where we find that they really look only at their own outcomes perceptually by the reaction times, for example. And individualists so are primarily concerned about their own outcomes and have no or very little regard for the outcomes of other people. And then the third group, and individualists are about like 30%. And then the third group is competitors. And that was a group that I found really shocking. When you look at how we measured it, it's basically an allocation game where people can allocate points to themselves and to another person. And then as a competitor, they are interested in enhancing the relative advantage over other people. So they prefer if they get 40 points and the other person gets, let's say, 30 points, they prefer that situation over a situation where they would get, let's say, 50 points, even more, and the other gets 20 points. Oh, sorry, 40 points. It's about relative difference. So let me make this very clear because that's very important. So they really look at what do I get more than the other person? And so sometimes, and that's guiding their lives. And if you see already a form of that you want to beat the other person in terms of points in this particular game, that's to me quite fascinating. And I still believe that competitors as a group, even though it's a small group, it's about 10%, are understudied because they actually, for various reasons. One reason is that theoretically they are very interesting. Competition is more generally a little bit understudied. We tend to focus on cooperation. And the second reason is actually that competitors are, it's very hard to persuade them to cooperate. You can persuade a individualist to cooperate, for example, by pursuing tit for tat, as it is called. So if you are going to be a conditional cooperator with a person that is individualistic in orientation, gradually you will persuade this individualist to become cooperative as well, because it's in his or her long-term self-interest. And so that's nice. So individualists, in a sense, are, you can call them, they take a business approach, they look after their own outcomes, but they are not unwilling to cooperate if they can benefit from it. But competitors are different because even if they can benefit from it themselves in terms of absolute outcomes, they still will not cooperate. And so that's why competitors actually, and let's say 10%, if you have 10% competitors, the likelihood that if you have a group of five or six or so, that a competitor is present every now and then is not so small. And we know also from research, together with Norbert Kerr, nice colleague of mine, very nice colleague, where we showed that, for example, bad apple effect, that if there is one bad apple in your group, you'll see that a lot of people will assimilate and also become, over time, non-cooperative. And so that's another reason why I think it's very important to study competitors. A very interesting group. Also, by the way, very interesting for you to know, how can you recognize those people? What another colleague of mine who passed away last year, but a very nice man, and I would like to mention his name, Mike Kuhlman. What he did was he looked at, for example, the faces of people and the emotions that they express when people are talking, and about something fairly trivial. And what he showed was when people are talking, when they are in action, pro-socials tend to smile more than individualists and competitors. And the indicators were the lip pulls, so to speak, the Ekman, Paul Ekman indicators, lip pulls, and the other indicators of the cheek raises, other indicators of smiling. And that actually is quite nice. And to me, this might indicate that pro-socials non-verbally invite some people, are more likely to invite some people to become interdependent with them, to invite them for small types of interactions. And that is actually could be a mechanism by which prosociality actually pays off, apart from what they're actually doing, but just the nonverbal gestures that they automatically share is very interesting. And I think the samples of Mike Kuhlman were not large enough to really make a difference between competitors and non-competitors, but I would not be surprised that the competitors would, especially when they are in action, and maybe especially when they are in action, in interaction with other people, that they sometimes show their maybe some disappointment. Their levels of trust do not tend to be high, especially from competitors. So you may see some, not so much enjoyment, let's put it mildly, in competitors.
The trust issue, again, is very interesting because not only do these people differ in how selfish versus cooperative they are, They also seem to differ in how selfish versus cooperative they think people are, or humanity is at large. And so something called the triangle hypothesis seems relevant here.
Yes. Yes, that's very interesting. And the triangle hypothesis is about that pro-socials in particular have a view of other people, that other people are either selfish or quite cooperative. But especially competitors have the view that other people are basically all selfish or competitive, and that there are hardly any pro-socials. And so the myth of self-interest, so to speak, or the myth of a sort of a competitive mindset may be especially strong among competitors, and to some degree individualists as well.
What do you think that is? I am selfish. Why would I think that everyone else is selfish? What is the causal direction? Is it that if I think everyone is selfish, then wow, I have to be selfish to survive in this harsh Hobbesian world? Or might it be the other way around, that if I am selfish, I'm looking for an excuse to just do whatever I want and just say, people are horrible, everyone else would have done the same. That's a convenient excuse.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's actually, you highlight one mechanism. I think to finding an excuse, people may actually anticipate on that kind of, let's call it an emotion to some degree, or mindset that immediately justifies your action. But I think there is, so that is certainly one, but I think there's a second mechanism. And I think the mechanisms could be that you're dealing with uncertainty, you're coping with uncertainty. And when you cope with uncertainty, you're more likely to be risk averse. And you think, and that mindset that the other person is individualistic or is not cooperative, is unlikely to be cooperative, is a mindset that by which you perceptually, actually, that you think you minimize any risks or losses. And that's actually, that could well be a misunderstanding, could be a bias that actually runs against you. But it's for the short term, and especially when you think of interactions with strangers, for example, then this mindset may, to some degree, there may be some logic to it. Let's put it this way. I still doubt it whether this mindset is a good mindset, because even with strangers, you can develop very nice interactions, and a pro-social mindset would also be not only be valid, and I can discuss that later on as well, but also be promote perhaps a self-fulfilling prophecy, because things like kindness are contagious, and they can help people, for example, at a certain moment, find a form of collaboration or cooperation in life that you would not detect if you keep distance.
Speaking of strangers, you have written about the importance of connecting with strangers, right? And speaking of trust, stranger danger, right? Someone's going to kidnap my child, and people do kidnap children, and it's horrible, obviously. So how can we ever trust strangers, and why should we?
Yeah, it's of course, with the disclaimer of if you're a young child, and sometimes also in dark situations, let's put it that way, even literally or not literally, but in dark situations, I probably would not recommend it. But in public places, like, for example, a grocery store, or you're waiting in line for a pop concert, for example, I typically start to talk to people. I sometimes enjoy going by myself to a pop concert, pop festival, more pop concert, I must admit. But then I enjoy it. And actually, this was also something that Robin Dunbar talked about. The connection that you make if you share the same music preferences is incredible. And so this is already interesting by itself. But what I find interesting in terms of interacting with strangers, and this was an eye-opener to me, and I developed those thoughts during COVID-19. I thought that when you think of strangers, actually, you don't have a conflict of interest, typically speaking, especially in open public places. When you're sitting on a bench in a park, why not initiate a conversation? Most people actually like this. And research by Nick Epley has actually shown that most people enjoy this and appreciate this. And I think the reason is also when you try to analyze it, it's basically the issue of the people that they are on the same page. It's a benign situation because the other person there's not a strong conflict of interest. Typically, there's a little bit of a sort of a situation where cooperation pays off and where people enjoy the interaction. So no conflict of interest at all. And also people are on an equal level, no strong power differences. And sometimes power differences can be threatening or maybe they bring about strong feelings of responsibility that you do not necessarily look for. So those two ingredients make the situation very benign. And that's one thing. And a second reason, which I also think is very important to realize, that most people are actually benign in terms of, certainly in terms of kindness. And the low-cost cooperation, so to just to talk to somebody, to just help somebody to find its way in a city, for example. There are so many examples of low-cost cooperation that people, most people do. And our research on social mindfulness, for example, is really providing a lot of support for this. Typically, social mindfulness, we have a nice measure about this. It's about not taking a unique item away from a list of items. So if you have three apples and two happen to be green and one is red, you should not take the red one because then the other person has no choice anymore. It's only green apples. So that's, and we made a measure out of this. And this measure, with this measure, actually, we show that people show a fair amount of social mindfulness. When you want to know a number, it's around 70% or so. And if they think, for example, that somebody else is not after you making a choice, then we see that there's no social mindfulness. There cannot be social mindfulness. But then people go for the red apple, let's say 50% of the time, and 50% of the time for the green apple, but for one of the two green apples. But if they know that another person is making a decision after you, then it's about 70%, typically, sometimes even more, that people go for the green apple so that the other person still has a choice. Now, this logic of social mindfulness also applies to everyday life. It's called low-cost cooperation, and people are just almost sometimes automatically doing this, like giving a smile to people to initiate the willingness to talk, perhaps. In Dutch, in Holland, we often say nice weather, because the weather is so important in the Netherlands, because it's often raining. But so once it's nice weather, people and share that joy of the sun, for example. Especially in the past, I'm not from a city, actually, originally. I was raised in a town, and there people would do that. In a city, a little bit less, although there's also community feelings in the city. So that's another reason. So the situations are benign. Most people are benign, are cooperative, you know, at least kind, let's put it that way. And so there's actually, and then you probably derive from that interaction, you provide happiness for yourself as well and for the other person. And there's research, again, by Nick Epley and others that actually show that even small exchanges in the public space, initiation of contact, are associated with a little bit of short-term happiness. So I really recommend this to people. It does make a difference. And especially younger people, why not? Because face-to-face contact, even small ones, do matter. And I would like to emphasize this even more strongly because Erik has told me that also quite a few younger people are listening to this podcast. Here's my clear advice.
I will certainly do my best to follow that advice. But it's also interesting in light of the fact that you have found that most interactions with people we have in everyday life are actually one-on-one interactions with people. They're not in big groups and tens, dozens of people all at once, even though this is what maybe comes to mind when we think about talking to people, quote unquote. But the most common form of social interaction in everyday life is the dyad.
Yeah, and that's to me a really fascinating topic. We have published a paper about it, and people, when they think of the last interaction and whether it's going to the theater or going out for dinner or even going on vacation, people often do it in a dyad than in groups of three or four or five. And we also did recently, we did some research in a park, two parks in Amsterdam and two big cafes also in Amsterdam. And we did observational studies. And there we also found, again, that dyads are just a much more prevalent kind of form of interaction or size, group size, than is groups of three or four or five. And actually, this tendency in real observation was a little bit stronger among women than among men. Also interesting, women tend to be a little bit more strongly focused on dyads than men are, who are a little bit more focused on groups. Now, but generally speaking, I think the dyads have a really strong advantage over groups. And one big advantage is in terms of trust and cooperation. The biggest advantage, the most important one, is the possibility of reciprocity. Because in dyads, you can use reciprocity. You cannot hide in a crowd, so to speak. And if you're cooperative, the other person will notice it and they can develop mutual cooperation. If you're non-cooperative, they can reciprocate by being not so cooperative. So the benefits of reciprocity are just amazing. And then I would say that in everyday life, in dyads, of course, every now and then happens that people do not work together very well, but I would say on average, chances that you work together very well because of reciprocity alone are much higher than in groups of three or four. And so if I were a teacher at elementary school, for example, I would split them in diets rather than in bigger groups of three or four. Then the second benefit, and that's also very important in my view, is there are certain emotions that really trigger prosociality. And one is empathy. And empathy is inherently a interpersonal emotion. You can feel empathy for one person, but not so much for a group. And I think the reason for this is that you feel empathy, and empathy may be aroused by one person because you can do something about it. For a group, it's very difficult to do something about it. So we have empathy as an emotion has evolved basically because it has functional value because you can help somebody. It may be rooted in, and that's very likely, in helpfulness towards your own children. And then, of course, it makes perfect sense from an evolutionary perspective that empathy is there, because otherwise you would not wake up if the baby is crying because you would be tired as a young parent all the time. But now you're waking up and you're offering help immediately. And empathy is a very strong, but you have to think of empathy as much broader than that, because empathy is also at place, for example, in when you are a listener to somebody. And if you are a good listener, especially in a one-to-one interaction, you need empathy and perspective taking to be a good listener. So you're constantly busy with perspective taking and the other as well. And that's much more likely to happen at the level of a diet, and that you are a real listener and also a real helper, than in a group where people are more likely to not either even to discuss those issues that are more intimate. Or because sometimes you may, for example, and brainstorming research has shown this, that people sometimes, they are mind-wandering and thinking about completely different topics because you're less of a perspective taker in the context of a group. But I think that's very important. And the third reason is, and that's a logic that we also discuss in a paper by Papercorn, and this is the logic that you cannot be excluded in a diet, at least at the cost of being that the other person will become lonely or not lonely, becomes alone, him or herself. And that's a powerful mechanism. That means that you cannot bully so much. Who is going to bully in a context of a diet? That would be silly. In a group, you can be bullied, you can be excluded, you can be marginalized. But in a diet, this is basically impossible. And turning back to that example of elementary school, if you are working together in diets, you feel much more safe. You can, for example, you are much more likely to dare a question that could perhaps be construed as stupid. Whereas in a group, you can be making fun of when you ask a stupid question, for example. And actually, I know from research in that area that this is actually a really a major concern among children at elementary school. So to me, this is a very powerful logic that you can apply in many situations. And I would like to say something about the practical implications about it, because this is so fascinating to me. Two things, because I teach courses to mayors in Holland, and I taught workshops. I've in small groups, typically 10 people, 10 mayors, and I probably have taught half of them in the Netherlands by now. And so I have a lot of knowledge about the issues that they face. And one of the issues is, of course, that either a city or a small town, a small district has issues with a particular group. But how do you deal with that as a mayor, for example? And what I always advise to the mayors is what you should do is you should not organize a meeting with the whole group. And what you should do is to reach out already constantly and interact on a one-to-one basis with the informal leaders of a group. Try to detect what the informal leaders are and have coffee with them, or tea if you are in England. But in Holland, you will discuss those things over coffee, for example. And that would really be a good thing to do, because then there's a connection already. And if you do it beforehand, then it also feels that you are interested in them, so you really show concern. It has all sorts of benefits in terms of procedural justice, but especially the idea of empathy that you can show for their concerns, for example. And then the group leader, and on a one-to-one basis, that is probably much more effective. And the second thing is that as part of this being involved with mayors, I also know that in cities in the Netherlands, also in Amsterdam, actually, there's a goal of trying to make the city a little bit like a community. And that you, for example, do not only watch people, but also interact with them. So it's a little bit of a goal there. And also to some degree rooted in the COVID-19. And so what happens if you have benches in a park? And the benches in a park are not situated that you can just look at passengers walking by, but suppose that the benches are in a particular angle positioned to one another. And in a particular angle, and then, for example, you face some kind of an animal or a piece of art, and people are sitting then on those benches. And the natural thing to predict is that people will initiate one-to-one interactions. And that would be so nice for people who are lonely, which is increasingly a problem, not only because people are getting much older, but also because of, we see that people take more distance. So when you have the goal to see how you can people make connections with one another, this could be a very nice tool to just, a very simple tool, and it's a very simple idea, actually, but it could be quite powerful. And all of a sudden, if people see that there's a lot of one-on-one interactions, then people may do it themselves much more quickly as well. That's, again, the descriptive norm. So I think there's a lot of logic and a lot of nice thing to say about the importance of the diet.
Speaking of practical implications, zooming out now to the last part of our interview, talking to you about you as a person who has come to adopt these research interests, trust and cooperation, they are most essential to social life. How have they become essential to your life? Do you think your life has changed in any way? Do you teach differently? Do you run your lab differently? Are there any implications of how you think about trust and cooperation that you think you wouldn't have had you not done all this research?
Very interesting question. Yeah, I think to some degree, I'm an extroverted person. And maybe I talk also much longer than I should, and even in a podcast. But I'm an extroverted person, so I do quickly initiate. I do not know what it is, but I have actually initiated a conversation with somebody, with a stranger. I've traveled alone a lot, actually, by going attending conferences, for example. Sometimes it was a day early. You go out for dinner by yourself. And I learned that this is a healthy lifestyle, actually. But I think that I was also informed by my own research to do that. And so actually, especially in recent years, that I was my own research and my own thinking was supported by this. Then the second thing that comes to my mind is actually that you describe yourself as individualistic. Eric, did you?
No,
you said something like, okay, that's very good that you correct this, because I didn't want to add to this misunderstanding at all, because you don't strike me as individualistic at all. Also, when listening to the other podcasts, you strike me as very pro-social. But apart from that, what I believe is that, especially in situations that are a little bit uncertain, and it's not that I always do this, but to give another person the benefit of the doubt is actually a healthy style. And again, this sounds that I'm preaching, but one of my most favorite pieces of research that I did in the past was about noise. And noise is about the idea that people may make unintended errors. So people may arrive too late for an appointment. People may say the wrong thing. And if you are really a tit-for-tatter, so to speak, or a reciprocator, you would, for example, increase distance, or you would not give this person necessarily the benefit of the doubt. And what I have learned from my own research at the time, it was published in 2002, more than 20 years ago, that I published this with two colleagues. But I still think the message is very strong. And there were some other people who had done computer simulations at the time, showing the same thing, that generosity is very important. And not to overdo it, but just to be a little bit more cooperative than the other person is very good and functional and beneficial to yourself as well, in the context of noise, where people do make mistakes, for example. And that has been maybe by nature I do it already to some degree. I'm not sure. That's for others to judge. My wife may have a completely different perspective on this. But I think, I'm sure that this is a healthy lifestyle. And this research showed it very clearly. We have two papers on this, and there were computer simulations. And I actually think that the idea of noise and social interaction and social dilemmas is a topic that is really under-addressed, because it's very important, because life is filled with noise. People make errors, sometimes intentionally, but often those errors, as the name suggests, they are unintentional. And it's very important to keep that in mind as a strategy for life, like how can I reserve judgment and to take the longer time perspective to some degree and give the other person the benefit of the doubt. A very powerful method.
Yeah, the beauty of giving someone the benefit of a doubt is that it can be self-fulfilling, right? because people love being appreciated and being trusted and really despise being distrusted. So it's not just that we're scouring other people and deciding if they can be trusted or not. We have some agency to make them more or less trustworthy to us. So I strongly agree.
Can I add one more thing? Because I completely agree with you. And something that I also find fascinating is the following. This is a conclusion that I reached in having done quite a bit of research over the last decade on reputation. I see reputation as the most important incentive in life, maybe next to money, but in many cases, it's probably more important than money, because reputation is something that has no head and has no tail, so to speak. Reputational concerns, they are not under your control. If other people develop some reputation of you, then you do not know where this is going, especially now, actually, with social media and with all sorts of things. And reputational concerns are so strong that they are the most powerful incentive, I think, underlying especially instrumental forms of cooperation. And that's very important to realize and to use a reputation as a tool. I already mentioned the idea of the Cleanest City Award, for example. That also uses reputation as a mechanism, as an ultimate mechanism. And that's also something I really learned. And this is also something that I must admit I probably strategically use every now in everyday life. I'm not proud of that but sometimes the reputation is so strong that, for example, people are more cooperative when there is some light. In darkness, they are probably less cooperative. You can use this logic in so many different ways. I once was asked to give advice at the red light district in Amsterdam. And I said, how about if you make those small LAs a little bit lighter? Or that you have some sort of control over the light. Because what happens actually is that people engage in norm violations if it's dark and when people are in groups and often alcohol is involved. But the darkness, you can do something about it by only the feeling that people feel observed is already very important. And that's something you can use it to your own benefit in everyday life, but you can also, as a policymaker, really use it to the benefit of the whole society. And that's my primary aim, by the way.
Except I would add, in cultures where you have a norm of self-interest, right? Where you are ashamed for being too trusting and open-minded, where you want to signal how distrustful and cynical you are. And I know that Dale Miller, who has done the work on the myth of self-interest that you mentioned earlier, he has found that sometimes people privately want to be kind, but then in public, when other people are observing them and their reputation is at stake, they become more selfish. Right? Because they have to signal this stupid, I don't trust people. I am independent. No one can be relied on. But actually, yeah, we are actively suppressing the kind of impulses we have just because of these self-interested norms.
It's perfect. I totally agree. And that's the idea with reputation and norms. The norms may be sometimes different, but it's always you only gain reputation basically by behaving norm consistent. And I completely agree with you. Yeah, that's an interesting remark. So you sometimes have to be careful with that as well. Yes, I agree.
Okay, I want to ask you one final question. You were living in the Netherlands now. I am originally from Germany. I went to college in Germany. And when I learned about the history of our field of psychology, I know that in the past, when the field started, we had different schools of thought. We had a more psychoanalytic thought in Europe and a more behaviorist approach a little later in the U.S. But right now, I am calling you from the U.S., and it seems like we're speaking the same language, literally and symbolically. Do you think there are still different schools of thought, different methodological approaches, let's say, in social psychology, depending on the country you are in? Or do you think we are mostly speaking the same language?
That's interesting. I think that historically speaking, that the differences have become smaller. So I'm in the field, let's say, as a PhD student since 87. And at that time, the publication cultures were very different, for example, in the United States versus, for example, my own country or Germany. The cultures have become more similar. That's one thing in terms of the emphasis on productivity, for example. Now we are actually facing a turning point, it seems, a little bit. Then the question is, of course, how we do research. And America has always been very empirical in research. And I think that basically Western Europe has adopted that model as well. And Southern Europe also, I would say a little bit after Western Europe, probably not Northwestern Europe. But generally speaking, I would say the differences have become smaller. And I What I traditionally, I also think that there were some countries, Germany, for example, has, this is a German term, Gründlichkeit, but in Germany, there is a strong emphasis on doing things right and interested in the measurement of things and deep personality differences and the conceptualization of it. Every country has still its features. I'm not even sure what the features of the Dutch are. I know that the Dutch are known that a lot of people study social dilemmas or study human cooperation, and they continue to do that. So I guess Holland is a country where human cooperation, social dilemmas is particularly a big topic, but that's accidental. And I could tell you actually the reason why this is. It probably has to do with an early connection between some professors in the Netherlands with UCSB in Santa Barbara, where Dave Messick was working. And Dave Messick was working on social dilemmas. And we basically, through collaboration, not me, but basically my supervisors, collaborated with him very early on. And they also spoke the same language at the time, but they also, yeah, there was synergy. And so at a certain moment, what happened was that in the Netherlands, we adopted the model, not only in terms of the paradigm itself and the methods, but also the tools to some degree. And that really helped to promote the topic of cooperation. So Dave Messick did not know that at the time. And I once told him this and he was completely surprised. But it's true. He has been an informal leader that many people did not know, actually.
Another virtue of us Germans is Pünktlichkeit or punctuality. A virtue of which I have been completely remiss in this conversation, as we have gone way longer than I promised you. But I'm very sorry, but I want to thank you for your time. This has been incredibly interesting, and I want to give you a final chance if you want to add anything. I know we have touched on many topics. Anything you want to add at the very end, and otherwise, to thank you for your time.
Yeah, I would like to thank you, Erik, because I've listened to several other podcasts, and those were extremely nice, and you are extremely well prepared and well informed. Sometimes I have the feeling that you were more of an expert than me, actually. So yes. I'm really, I'm a little bit making a joke, but it's really, therefore, it's really a pleasure. And that's also why I take much more time than I anticipated. But I hope that the listener can enjoy it and appreciate it.
I hope so too. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Following Robert Cialdini's advice here on this podcast, let's see if I can convince you to take about 5 seconds of your valuable time and leave us a quick review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or elsewhere. This podcast has been a labor of love by several wonderful young folks here in the department, and we have been surprised by the ever-increasing reach the podcast has had. We are near 500,000 downloads a year and a half since we started, with tens of thousands of new downloads and thousands of new followers every single month in nearly every country around the world. Help us make even more people excited about psychology by leaving us a review or subscribing to our no spam, all fun Substack at Stanford Psy Pod to connect with other listeners, or shoot us an email with your thoughts or suggestions at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, and have a wonderful psyched day.